Each of us yearns for unity and meaning and justice. We want to connect to our life, to touch the wonder at its roots.
Schooling indoctrinates youngsters into the world without challenging it, without imagining alternatives. It's a claustrophobic, cramped place to be in, and with every new initiative getting further mired in different dead ends.
And to live in a world that is not governed by petty tyrants, be they people or systems. When it is not there, we can sense its absence.
Meanwhile, in the real world, our education fails to be a civilizing force.
Hi, I'm the author of Against Capitalist Education, published by Zero Books, and this is the Against Capitalist Education podcast. My guest this week is Dr. Atul Patel. Atul has for a period of over 30 years been pursuing a personal interest in the spiritual sciences of Rudolf Steiner, and he finds the value of Steiner and Steiner's response both to the philosophical tradition and to questions of spirituality in the 20th century of extreme and profound value. For Atul, Steiner steps outside a lot of the categories and is certainly not to be condemned as a New Age thinker. This is the first part of a two-part conversation. It's about the idea that for most people, when they think about science, and we don't want to condemn the whole lot of it and pretend it's all rubbish, but most people think about science that it's objective, you know, it doesn't muck about, shall we say, let's put it crudely. Mm-hmm. And it's just quite interesting to hear that actually it's quite a big machine in terms of acquiring funding, mm-hmm. Research projects, what projects are chosen. So maybe my general feeling is, and question would be to ask you, that is science, what we understand science, A, in your view, given the fact that you've got your PhD in physics, you've got a physics degree, you've come through the system, you understand how it's worked and operated within it, is your view that science is a basically definitive? You know, it's the science and really there's nothing more to be added. So all those people, say, interested in spiritual sciences or mm-hmm. which link to the kind of bigger questions about how we should live, what the nature of human beings are, it's all kind of mumbo-jumbo, that stuff, because actually it's all science. So maybe we could start somewhere around there.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the phrase you use about massaging the figures, I think I remember when I said that, was the problem with science at the moment, and it has been for a long time, is that it's what you call purely hypothetical. You hypothesize and then you test the hypotheses, and even if it's a negative outcome, then you can still publish the paper.
Okay, so what does that mean? So
it means that you can rise up in the citation rankings and become a professorship without actually contributing to culture in a positive way.
Ah, okay. Now, this is not to condemn science, because I understand you're not doing that. We both have very positive views about the value and the benefit of science and reason and the rest of it. But this is a very, very important point. So you could basically build up a career, arrive at a very high position by doing effectively something like negative research.
Yeah, and so getting things wrong, effectively. Having a negative hypothesis. For example, cold fusion, nothing really happened with that.
Yeah.
People think that they genuinely had a real result and that it was going to revolutionize the whole energy industry. But it was some guys making some error. But at that time, when they would have published it, they would have done really well in terms of career-wise, because a lot of people would have referred to that paper, and they effectively could have who used it to enhance their career. Citation rankings and become a professorship without actually contributing to culture in a positive way. In terms of career-wise, because a lot of people would have referred to that paper and they effectively could have used it to enhance their career.
If you're talking about going on to something like spiritual sciences,
what's really the
the problem we face, the way I see it is that we haven't really grasped what epistemology is. When we talk about truth and knowledge, I don't think that problem's been solved other than by Rudolf Steiner, because he took Kant's work. So he took all Kant's work was a very important milestone in philosophical history, because you could take all of epistemology right up to the point of Kant, because Kant tried to summarize what all the issues and the thorny problems were.
Just in case there's anyone listening and might say, what's this word epistemology? Epistemology is about the nature of knowledge, how we know things, how knowledge works. Would that be fair to say in the simplest way?
What we call truth and why we feel like we're justified in our belief in what we say is true.
In holding things to be true.
Yeah. And the problem was is that we don't have a correct starting point. There's a number of things. One, we don't have a correct starting point in epistemology, because you can't really say anything about anything until you've actually observed the process of cognition itself. So let me elaborate on that. I don't think that problem's been solved other than by Rudolf Steiner, because he took Kant's work. So he took all Kant's work was a very important milestone in philosophical history, because you could take all of epistemology right up to the point of Kant, because Kant tried to summarize what all the issues epistemology is not really a theory of something, or a hypothesis or an elaboration of like a network of thought saying this is what it is. Epistemology is actually describing to yourself, observing a process that happens, because we already know that certain things are absolutely true. For example, you're sitting on a stool. Mm-hmm. Would you say that's a stool? Yeah?
Yeah.
Would you say that is absolutely true? It's absolute fact that it's a stool.
Yeah, my only problem would be using the word absolute. I would say it's a fact. I'm not sure what the word fact. Absolute would add. But it's a fact we can both agree on now.
Exactly. And the fact that we can agree upon it, and the fact that we think that is true, mm-hmm. we don't need to believe in it. We don't need to have a scientific experiment to prove it.
Right. Yeah.
And so the interesting thing about that is that in your cognition of the stool, or really a recognition of the stool, is that you've already undergone a process where you've established a piece of knowledge and that it's true.
Okay. Yeah? Okay.
So the point I'm trying to make here is that we already know what is true, and have that process. But what we haven't done is actually described it to ourselves, elaborated it, observed it in such a way. And this is what Rudolf Steiner tried to do. And the reason he did that is because then you see that there's actually no limits to knowledge. I'm kind of jumping ahead of
to the end. Yeah.
There's no limits to knowledge because that whole process you can apply to your inner world as well, where you start to looking at more subtler things going on. But crude things like your thoughts, imagination, your feelings, various emotions, desire, all of this, all of your inner world. And when you start applying that whole cognition process, that is your... it would take some elaboration for me to actually describe what the process is in terms
we
of
might
the
come
mystopology.
To that.
We can come to some other time.
Yeah.
But the point is that he's articulated what the process is, and that you can see that you can apply it not just to the outer world but to the inner world, and hence you can have a spiritual science. And this is what Rudolf Steiner tried to do, and the reason he did that is because then you see that there's actually no limits to knowledge. I'm kind of jumping ahead of
to the end.
There's no limits to knowledge because that whole process you can apply to your inner world as well, where you start to looking at more subtler things going on. But crude things like your thoughts, imagination, your feelings, various emotions, desire, all of this, all of your inner world. And when you start applying that whole cognition process, that is your...
That's a brilliant place for me to sort of get a foothold in here. You see, the idea in the back of my mind, people say words like epistemology, they talk about science and knowledge, and they tend to think that's the domain of science and whatever science does. And then when they talk about, if they've heard of Rudolf Steiner, it's fascinating that if you look at your trajectory, so you did a PhD, mm-hmm. then you came out of the system with a disappointment or some sense that it was something about it wasn't quite right. And for the rest of your life, having to earn a wage, do a job, bring up a family, along in parallel and woven into all of that, you've pursued consistently an interest to try to explore that part. It would be a fair way of characterizing, would you say, about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely.
See, that's quite fascinating, because some of the things that we've discussed in the past, which I find absolutely fascinating as well, which I'd like to, if you're okay, to pick your thoughts over, if you can remember the kind of things.
Yeah.
Because Steiner, I think, is a really big one. Steiner is, for those... people who have not heard of Rudolf Steiner understand what he's about. They might have heard of the education system he invented, but it's fair to say you haven't been involved in so much the education, but more exploring how he's trying to resolve stuff. Now, Steiner wasn't, again, an easy person to categorize. He had a very scientific, intellectual side, as well as having a very profoundly spiritual side.
Yep.
And it's that kind of figure that I think we need more time to talk about, because there's a link, interesting link to Goethe as well, which I'd like to draw your thoughts on. But I'd like to go back a few steps. The first thing I find fascinating, because your day job takes you into all kinds of areas around the finance markets, and you have a lot of experience and understanding about how those things work. About how economics, your views on economics. You had some very fascinating ideas for me about the way that... I'm going to crudely characterize what I can remember and see if you're happy to try to bounce off that.
Yeah.
You had some views about how our economic systems are somehow... Okay, A, they're flawed, but the flaw isn't so... It's your position, because you're sophisticated, your understanding of financial and economic systems is much more complicated and sophisticated than mine. That there's something... They're very subtle flaws within the system that perpetuate certain aspects of it. It was almost as if what would... My question that you seem to be exploring was that there was almost a... There is an alternative way of organising our economic life, even with the current models that we have, tweaking them in certain kind of ways, which would massively change certain aspects of our life.
That's right.
Which is one of the aspects that I said. Yeah. So, you know, you can... What we're not talking about is anarchism, where you just reject the whole system and you go back into the kind of local barterism rubbish. Yep. I mean, most people agree that
we need a global system, but the questions need to be sophisticated. How our economic systems are somehow... Okay, A, they're flawed, but the flaw isn't so... It's your position, because you're sophisticated, your understanding of financial and economic systems is much more complicated and sophisticated than mine, that there's something... There are very subtle flaws within the system that perpetuate certain aspects of it.
It's not terribly flawed. It needs a slight tweak.
Okay.
And the interesting point is that a government can create money.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But the bizarre thing at the moment is that when the government creates money, it borrows that money. Yeah. So it creates it as a loan.
Okay.
Yeah. And then you, if you use that money. To inject in, whether it's to the public infrastructure or public services, or it's funding something else, then the government is going to incur a huge debt, right? That's
okay.
One way of doing it, and that's the current way.
Can I just ask you, because I'm not an expert at all, so it's quite helpful, and also people who might be fascinated by this. When it borrows money, who does it borrow it from? What do you mean it borrows
exactly
money? Okay.
And that's the interesting thing.
Right. Okay.
So it's borrowing it from a central bank. So for us in the UK, that's the Bank of England. But that's a government organisation or an institution as well.
Okay.
So the government is effectively borrowing it from itself.
Right.
And that's the absurdity. Yeah? Because you don't have to do it that way.
Okay.
If you think about alternatives and how could you do it,
yep.
You could say, well, okay, we'll create money. Yeah,
right,
the government
right.
will create money.
Yeah.
Same thing. But instead of borrowing it, I'll just spend it into the economy. Yeah?
Okay.
So I don't have a debt. So there's no account saying UK government in the Bank of England set of accounts,
yeah,
saying that it's got however trillion in debt, right?
Right.
What would happen is that it'll create money, it'll spend it into the economy, and it'll spend it on, could be like, let's be topical, flood defences, for example.
Construction projects,
construction
flood defences.
Construction
projects, yeah.
You know, rebuild infrastructure,
yeah.
Rebuild up motorways, or fund the NHS, whatever you want to do. Yeah?
New alternative energy sources, fund the research into
absolutely, it. Absolutely. It can be anything like that, but then here's the catch. You can't overdo it. Because what happens is that if you pump too much money into the system too soon, then you create hyperinflation,
okay.
Which you don't want.
Yeah.
It's all right to have a little bit of inflation.
Okay.
In fact, what you would want is you want to have like some sort of inflation target, a band. Let's
yeah.
say it's plus or minus 2%,
okay.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And then you allow inflation to stay within that range, and you monitor it really carefully. But at the same time, you're gradually pumping new money into where it's needed, into the real economy, right?
Okay.
And when
yeah.
we say the real economy, we're really talking about, you know, real jobs, real people, real services that are being provided, not being pumped into the finance system,
okay.
Where the finance system might then take those funds and then invest it into assets, for example.
Okay.
Like
futures.
Well, not the futures, but just like into equities, and so the FTSE goes up, but it's creating an asset bubble.
Right.
But that's not really real, right? Because
okay.
they're just getting this new money, and it's being pumped into a wrong direction. At some point, that will have to correct itself. So you get a crash, and then you get a shock in the market, and that's exactly what's happening. You're getting this cycle of asset bubbles
right.
coming from this excess credit growth,
yeah.
creating a shock in the market. Creating recessions, and then we're just caught in that loop constantly. And we need to get out of that. And you do that by having a clearer understanding of how money gets created and how you use that money. And there's various people. You should check out positivemoney.org, and you should check out the American Monetary Institute, just to name a couple of charity think tanks that have spent a lot of time on this. So it's borrowing it from a central bank. So for us in the UK, that's the Bank of England. But that's a government organisation or institution as well.
Okay.
So the government is effectively borrowing it from itself. Right. And that's the absurdity. Yeah? Because you don't have to do it that way. Okay. If you think about alternatives and how could you do it,
yeah,
you could say, well, okay, we'll create money. Yeah.
Right,
the government will create money.
Yeah.
Same thing. But instead of borrowing it, I'll just spend it into the economy.
Can I ask you, is this connected to what you once said to me about the fact that money can disconnect from reality? I can't remember how you put it before, and I wonder if it's connected or a similar point you're making now. This idea that money, you can circulate money around the system, but when you actually translate it back into real goods, real jobs, real projects, real activity, it's somehow got out of touch, or there's a disconnect.
So what can happen is that it can kind of go into the shadow banking system, and or just some aspects of the financial system, where you can have this thing where a government is creating money. You call it quantitative easing.
Yeah.
You know? But it's done in such a way that the money kind of ends up sitting on a bank's balance sheet, and they may then invest it into something else, like equities, for example, and creating this asset bubble. And that's where that's what you don't want to happen, because that's not going into the real economy.
Right. Yeah? It's not creating a job. It's not being spent on real work.
Exactly. So with Jeremy Corbyn and his like quantitative easing for the people, the idea is that it should go directly to the real economy. So you create the money, you identify the areas where you want to fund, you fund them directly, and you use the banks as intermediaries. So the banks would channel this new money as loans into these areas. Well, with the public services, it may not necessarily be as a loan. It may be just as grant money.
Okay. Actually.
So you've got different forms of...
How you distribute the cash.
Different forms of distribution channels, because you may want to give it as a grant, mm-hmm. or you may want to give it as a loan, let's say, to a medium-sized company that's doing well, it needs to grow,
mm-hmm.
In which case... they would be offered a loan based upon some sort of interest rate charge, which is agreed through the bank. So the banks still play a part in this, but it's done centrally through something like the Monetary Creation Committee, which is an idea that the Positive Money are playing around with. And that Creation Committee, that would be kind of... in conjunction with the Monetary Policy Committee, and the Monetary Policy Committee would then play a part in identifying, how well we're meeting the inflation target and how much more money, or it's just done through the Monetary Creation Committee. The point is, you've got a central bank set of experts who are overseeing this whole process, and it can work. I think what we need to figure out is that the banks still are viable through this new model, and that they can still, make money. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to get the buy-in.
Yeah. Okay. So that's fascinating. So let's just. So for the time being, what we're talking about is staying roughly within the parameters that we have. But actually, what you're saying is that even within the parameters we have, there are different views about how you could go around generating money to help create a more stable world, a better world? What would you? How would you characterize the broader ambition of what you're saying it's doing?
Yeah, I mean, it just leads to actually limitless and fantastic opportunities, because then you can fund all sorts of research. There's no limit now.
Okay.
The only limit is that you can't let inflation get away with you. But effectively, if you do it properly, you can pump into lots of different businesses, a lot of startups, a lot of research projects, a lot of new think tanks, you know?
So why don't they do it?
Why don't they do it? That's an interesting
question. That's a big question, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it just leads to actually limitless and fantastic opportunities, because then you can fund all sorts of research. There's no limit now.
Okay.
The only limit is that you can't let inflation get away with you. But effectively, if you do it properly, you can pump into lots of different businesses, a lot of startups, a lot of research projects, a lot of new think tanks, you know?
So why don't they do it?
Why don't they do it? That's an interesting
question. That's a big question, isn't it?
It is. Now, either they know about this, and then they want to suppress that as an alternative in order to keep things as they are, because it benefits some sort of rich elite. Let's say it's all the rich landowners in the UK, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
Or nobody's really kind of understood it well enough, because you know, economics and monetary policy, it's not an easy subject anyway.
It isn't an easy subject, no, absolutely.
Especially for the layperson, but even for economists, it's not an easy subject, and they don't always agree with each other.
No.
So it's probably, you know, the latter. And what we need is, and it's like what the Positive Money and American Monetary Institute are trying to do. They're trying to spread the word. They're trying to, you know, create blogs and articles and write books and have videos on YouTube to spread the word and to plant some seeds saying, this is how you could do it. Here's the alternative. You know, try to engage with it. Have a think about it. And slowly but surely, we could turn things around.
That's a fascinating idea, because at some point, some time in the past, we were also talking about various different conspiracies within the global systems that we have and how they hold things back.
Yeah.
Without, you know, planning this out, just thinking about what you're saying to me, the idea that education, again, has to play a part within trying to show alternative ways the economic system could function. With these tweak that you talk, you're not talking about wholesale rejection of the current system with replacing it with something new.
No, it's tweaking it.
And it's fascinating.
It's literally tweaking it.
And
you know?
It could be incredibly powerful and useful. So, you know, with the book, with Against Capitalist Education, economics is the subject that I think is probably the toughest one to tackle. Because, as you say, it's one which is it is more complex than we give it credit for.
Mm-hmm.
But actually bringing it into an education system. So if I were teaching and building a syllabus, where would you get your material for the kind of person you would want to say?
Yeah, I would go to the Positive Money website, because they're trying to reach out to the everyday person.
Okay.
And so they are creating videos, they're creating articles to try and explain these things. So
that's a powerful starting point.
It is a powerful starting point. And I did some work with them recently as part of a charity work that we do. So we're trying to understand. I was trying to describe to them, you know, how the structure of a bank looks like with all a universal bank. So a universal bank is made up of all different businesses.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a credit card service, it's got an investment bank, it's got a retail bank, and so on and so forth. And then that was like the first half of the day. The second half of the day is, okay, let's take your new approach to, can we then figure out whether this bank can actually still make some money, and where would it make money, right?
Okay, using this model, yeah.
Yeah, because we're not going to get the buy-in if banks can't make money under it.
Okay,
you know, the simple rule.
So
and banks will still be able to make money, but we've got to articulate where they will make money and where they have to cut back on certain areas.
But I would definitely recommend the Positive Money website for as a starting point for material.
Each of us yearns for unity and meaning and justice. We want to connect to our life, to touch the wonder at its root, and to live in a world that is not governed by petty tyrants, be they people or our systems. When it's not there, we can sense its absence. Thank you for listening. I'd like to thank Zero Books and Doug Lane for supporting this podcast. For more, go to the Zero Books website or tune in to Zero Squared, the Zero Books podcast with Doug Lane.